now. But Desi could hold his bit and point him, the way a handler points a thoroughbred at the barrier to show his breeding and his form. Desi lay, part in pain, and part of her dangled still in sleep while the morning brightened against the window. She remembered that Molly was going to lead the Grand March at the 4th of July picnic, with no less than Harry Forbes, state senator. And Desi hadn't finished putting the braid on Molly's dress. She struggled to get up. There was so much braid, and here she lay, drowsing. She cried, "I'll get it done, Molly. It'll be ready." She got up from her bed and threw her robe around her and walked barefooted through the house crowded with Hamiltons. In the hall, they were gone to the bedrooms. In the bedrooms, with the beds neat made, they were all in the kitchen. And in the kitchen, they dispersed and were gone. Sadness and death. The wave receded and left her in dry awakeness. The house was clean, scrubbed, and immaculate. Curtains washed, windows polished, but all as a man does it. The iron curtains didn't hang quite straight, and there were streaks on the windows, and a square showed on the table when a book was moved. The stove was warming, with orange light showing around the lids and the soft thunder of drafty flame leaping past the open damper. The kitchen clock flashed its pendulum behind its glass skirt, and it ticked like a little wooden hammer striking on an empty wooden box. From outside came a whistle as wild and raucous as a reed and pitched high and strange. The whistling scattered a savage melody. Then Tom's steps sounded on the porch, and he came in with an armload of oak wood so high he couldn't see over it. He cascaded the wood into the wood box. "You're up," he said. "That was to wake you if you were still sleeping." His face was lighted with joy. "This is a morning light as down, and no time to be slugging."
"You sound like your father," Desi said, and she laughed with him.
His joy hardened to fierceness. "Yes," he said loudly, "and we'll have that time again, right here. I've been dragging myself in misery like a spine-broken snake. No wonder Will thought I was cracked. But now you're back, and I'll show you. I'll breathe life into life again. Do you hear? This house is going to be alive."
"I'm glad I came," she said. And she thought in desolation how brittle he was now, and how easy to shatter, and how she would have to protect him.
"You must have worked day and night to get the house so clean," she said.
"Nothing," said Tom. "A little twist with the fingers."
"I know that twist, but it was with a bucket and mop and on your knees. Unless you invented some way to do it by chicken power or the harnessed wind."
"Invented? Now that's why I have no time. I have invented a little slot that lets a necktie slip around freely in a stiff collar."
"You don't wear stiff collars."
"I did yesterday. That's when I invented it. And chickens. I'm going to raise millions of them. Little houses all over the ranch, and a ring on the roof to dip them in a whitewash tank. And the eggs will come through on a little conveyor belt. Here, I'll draw it."
"I want to draw some breakfast," Desi said. "What's the shape of a fried egg? How would you color the fat and lean of a strip of bacon?"
"You'll have it," he cried.
And he opened the stove lid and assaulted the fire with the stove lifter until the hairs on his hand curled and charred. He pitched wood in and started his high whistling. Desi said, "You sound like some goat foot with a wheat flute on a hill in Greece."
"What do you think I am?" he shouted.
Desi thought miserably. "If his is real, why can't my heart be light? Why can't I climb out of my gray rag bag?"
"I will," she screeched inside herself. "If he can, I will."
She said, "Tom?"
"Yes?"
"I want a purple egg."
Chapter 33 The green lasted on the hills far into June before the grass turned yellow. The heads of the wild oats were so heavy with seed that they hung over on their stalks. The little springs trickled on late into the summer. The range cattle staggered under their fat, and their hides shone with health. It was a year when the people of the Salinas Valley forgot the dry years. Farmers bought more land than they could afford and figured their profits on the covers of their checkbooks. Tom Hamilton labored like a giant, not only with his strong arms and rough hands, but also with his heart and spirit. The anvil rang in the forge again. He painted the old house white and whitewashed the sheds. He went to King City and studied a flush toilet, and then built one of craftily bent tin and carved wood. Because the water came so slowly from the spring, he put a redwood tank beside the house and pumped the water up to it with a handmade windmill so cleverly made that it turned in the slightest wind. And he made metal and wood models of two ideas to be sent to the patent office in the fall. That was not all. He labored with humor and good spirits. Dessie had to rise very early to get in her hand at the housework before Tom had it all done. She watched his great red happiness, and it was not light as Samuel's happiness was light. It didn't rise out of his roots and come floating up. He was manufacturing happiness as cleverly as he knew how, molding it and shaping it. Dessie, who had more friends than anyone in the whole valley, had no confidants. When her trouble had come upon her, she hadn't talked about it, and the pains were a secret in herself. When Tom found her rigid and tight from the grabbing pain and cried in alarm, "Dessie, what's the matter?" She controlled her face and said, "A little crick, that's all. Just a little crick. I'm all right." And in a moment they were laughing. They laughed a great deal, as though to reassure themselves. Only when Dessie went to her bed did her loss fall on her, bleak and unendurable. And Tom lay in the dark of his room, puzzled as a child. He could hear his heart beating and rasping a little in its beat. His mind fell away from thought and clung for safety to little plans, designs, machines. Sometimes in the summer evenings they walked up the hill to watch the afterglow clinging to the tops of the western mountains and to feel the breeze drawn into the valley by the rising day-heated air. Usually they stood silent for a while and breathed in peacefulness. Since both were shy, they never talked about themselves. Neither knew about the other at all. It was startling to both of them when Dessie said one evening on the hill, "Tom, why don't you get married?" He looked quickly at her and away. He said, "Who'd have me?" "Is that a joke, or do you really mean it?" "Who'd have me?" he said again. "Who'd want a thing like me?" "It sounds to me as though you really mean it." Then she violated their unstated code. "Have you been in love with someone?"
"No,"
he said shortly. "I wish I knew," she said, as though he hadn't answered. Tom didn't speak again as they walked down the hill. But on the porch he said suddenly, "You're lonely here. You don't want to stay." He waited for a moment. "Answer me. Isn't that true?" "I want to stay here more than I want to stay anyplace else." She asked, "Do you ever go to women?"
"Yes," he said.
"Is it any good to you?"
"Not much."
"What are you going to do?"
"I don't know."
In silence, they went back to the house. Tom lighted the lamp in the old living room. The horsehair sofa he had rebuilt raised its gooseneck against the wall, and the green carpet had tracks worn light between the doors. Tom sat down by the round center table. Dessie sat on the sofa, and she could see that he was still embarrassed from his last admission. She thought how pure he is, how unfit for a world that even she knew more about than he did. A dragon killer he was, a rescuer of damsels, and his small sins seemed so great to him that he felt unfit and unseemly. She wished her father were here. Her father had felt greatness in Tom. Perhaps he would know how to release it out of its darkness and let it fly free. She took another tack to see whether she could raise some spark in him. "As long as we're talking about ourselves, Have you ever thought that our whole world is the valley and a few trips to San Francisco? And have you ever been farther south than San Luis Obispo? I never have.
Neither have I, said Tom.
Well, isn't that silly?
Lots of people haven't, he said.
But it's not a law. We could go to Paris and to Rome or to Jerusalem. I would dearly love to see the Colosseum.
He watched her suspiciously, expecting some kind of joke.
How could we?
He asked. That takes a lot of money.
I don't think it does, she said. We wouldn't have to stay in fancy places. We could take the cheapest boats in the lowest class. That's how our father came here from Ireland. And we could go to Ireland.
Still he watched her, but a burning was beginning in his eyes. Dessie went on.
We could take a year for work, save every penny. I can get some sewing to do in King City. Will would help us. And next summer you could sell all the stock and we could go. There's no law forbids it.
Tom got up and went outside. He looked up at the summer stars, at blue Venus and red Mars. His hands flexed at his sides, closed to fists, and opened. Then he turned and went back into the house. Dessie hadn't moved.
Do you want to go, Dessie?
More than anything in the world.
Then we will go.
Do you want to go?
More than anything in the world, he said.
And then,
Egypt! Have you given a thought to Egypt?
Athens, she said.
Constantinople.
Bethlehem.
Yes, Bethlehem.
And he said suddenly,
Go to bed. We've got a year of work. A year. Get some rest. I'm going to borrow money from Will to buy 100 shoats.
What'll you feed them?
Acorns, said Tom. I'll make a machine to gather acorns.
After he had gone to his room, she could hear him knocking around and talking softly to himself. Dessie looked out her window at the starlit night, and she was glad. But she wondered whether she really wanted to go, or whether Tom did. And as she wondered, the whisper of pain grew up from her side. When Dessie got up in the morning, Tom was already at his drawing board, beating his forehead with his fist and growling to himself. Dessie looked over his shoulder.
Is it the acorn machine?
It should be easy, he said. But how to get out the sticks and rocks?
I know you're the inventor, but I invented the greatest acorn picker in the world, and it's ready to go.
What do you mean?
Children, she said. Those restless little hands.
They wouldn't do it, not even for pay.
They'd do it for prizes. A prize for everyone, and a big prize for the winner. Maybe a $100 prize. They'd sweep the valley clean. Will you let me try?
He scratched his head.
Why not? He said. But how would you collect the acorns?
The children will bring them in, said Dessie. Just let me take care of it. I hope you have plenty of storage space.
It'd be exploiting the young, wouldn't it?
Certainly it would, Dessie agreed.
When I had my shop, I exploited the girls who wanted to learn to sew, and they exploited me. I think I'll call this the Great Monterey County Acorn Contest. And I won't let everyone in. Maybe bicycles for prizes. Wouldn't you pick up acorns in hope of a bicycle, Tom?
Sure I would, he said.
But couldn't we pay them, too?
Not with money, Dessie said. That would reduce it to labor, and they will not labor if they can help it.
Nor will I.
Tom leaned back from his board and laughed.
Nor will I, he said. All right. You're in charge of acorns, and I'm in charge of pigs.
Dessie said, Tom, wouldn't it be ridiculous if we made money? We, of all people.
But you made money in Salinas, he said.
Some, not much. But, oh, I was rich in promises. If the bills had ever been paid, we wouldn't need pigs. We could go to Paris tomorrow.
I'm going to drive in and talk to Will, said Tom.
He pushed his chair back from the drawing board.
Want to come with me?
No, I'll stay and make my plans.
Tomorrow I start the Great Acorn Contest.
On the ride back to the ranch in the late afternoon, Tom was depressed and sad. As always, Will had managed to chew up and spit out his enthusiasm. Will had pulled his lip, rubbed his eyebrows, scratched his nose, cleaned his glasses, and made a major operation of cutting and lighting a cigar. The pig proposition was full of holes, and Will was able to put his fingers in the holes. The acorn contest wouldn't work, although he was not explicit about why it wouldn't. The whole thing was shaky, particularly in these times. The very best Will was able to do was to agree to think about it. At one time during the talk, Tom had thought to tell Will about Europe, but a quick instinct stopped him. The idea of traipsing around Europe, unless of course you were retired and had your capital out in good securities, would be to Will a craziness that would make the pig plan a marvel of business acumen. Tom didn't tell him, and he left Will to think it over, knowing that the verdict would be against the pigs and the acorns. Poor Tom didn't know and couldn't learn that dissembling successfully is one of the creative joys of a businessman. To indicate enthusiasm was to be idiotic, and Will really did mean to think it over. Parts of the plan fascinated him. Tom had stumbled on a very interesting thing. If you could buy shoats on credit, fatten them on food that costs next to nothing, sell them, pay off your loan, and take your profit, you would really have done something. Will wouldn't rob his brother. He would cut him in on the profits, but Tom was a dreamer and couldn't be trusted with a good, sound plan. Tom, for instance, didn't even know the price of pork and its probable trend. If it worked out, Will could be depended on to give Tom a very substantial present, maybe even a Ford. And how about a Ford as first and only prize for acorns? Everybody in the whole valley would pick acorns. Driving up to Hamilton Road, Tom wondered how to break it to Desi that their plan was no good. The best way would be to have another plan to substitute for it. How could they make enough money in 1 year to go to Europe? And suddenly he realized that he didn't know how much they'd need. He didn't know the price of a steamship ticket. They might spend the evening figuring. He half expected Desi to run out of the house when he drove up. He'd put on his best face and tell a joke. But Desi didn't run out. Maybe taking a nap, he thought. He watered the horses and stabled them and pitched hay into the manger. Desi was lying on the gooseneck sofa when Tom came in. "Taking a nap?" he asked. And then he saw the color of her face. "Desi," he cried, "what's the matter?" She rallied herself against the pain. "Just a stomach ache," she said. "A pretty severe one." "Oh," said Tom, "you scared me. I can fix up a stomach ache." He went to the kitchen and brought back a glass of pearly liquid. He handed it to her. "What is it, Tom?" "Good old-fashioned salts. It may gripe you a little, but it'll do the job." She drank it obediently and made a face. "I remember that taste," she said. "Mother's remedy in green apple season." "Now you lie still," Tom said. "I'll rustle up some dinner." She could hear him knocking about in the kitchen. The pain roared through her body. And on top of the pain, there was fear. She could feel the medicine burn down to her stomach. After a while, she dragged herself to the new homemade flush toilet and tried to vomit the salts. The perspiration ran from her forehead and blinded her. When she tried to straighten up, the muscles over her stomach were set, and she couldn't break free. Later, Tom brought her some scrambled eggs. She shook her head slowly. "I can't," she said, smiling. "I think I'll just go to bed." "The salt should work pretty soon," Tom assured her. "Then you'll be all right." He helped her to bed. "What do you suppose you ate to cause it?" Desi lay in her bedroom, and her will battled the pain. About 10 o'clock in the evening, her will began to lose its fight. She called, "Tom? Tom?" He opened the door. He had the World Almanac in his hand. "Tom," she said, "I'm sorry, but I'm awfully sick. Tom, I'm terribly sick." He sat down on the edge of her bed in the half-darkness. "Are the gripes bad?" "Yes, awful."
Can you go to the toilet now? No, not now. I'll bring a lamp and sit with you, he said. Maybe you can get some sleep. It'll be gone in the morning. The salts will do the job.
Her will took hold again, and she lay still while Tom read bits out of the almanac to soothe her. He stopped reading when he thought she was sleeping, and he dozed in his chair beside the lamp. A thin scream awakened him. He stepped beside the struggling bedclothes. Dessie's eyes were milky and crazy, like those of a maddened horse. Her mouth corners erupted thick bubbles, and her face was on fire. Tom put his hand under the cover and felt muscles knotted like iron. And then her struggle stopped, and her head fell back, and the light glinted on her half-closed eyes. Tom put only a bridle on the horse and flung himself on bareback. He groped and ripped out his belt to beat the frightened horse to an awkward run over the stony, rutted wheel track. The Duncans, asleep upstairs in their two-story house on the county road, didn't hear the banging on their door, but they heard the bang and ripping sound as their front door came off, carrying lock and hinges with it. By the time Red Duncan got downstairs with a shotgun, Tom was screaming into the wall telephone at the King City Central.
Dr. Tilson, get him! I don't care! Get him! Get him, goddammit!
Red Duncan sleepily had the gun on him.
Dr. Tilson said, Yes, 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 I hear you. You're Tom Hamilton. What's the matter with her? Is her stomach hard? What did you do? Salts, you goddamn fool!
Then the doctor controlled his anger.
Tom, he said, Tom, boy, pull yourself together. Go back and lay cold cloths, cold as you can get them. I don't suppose you have any ice. Well, keep changing the cloths. I'll be out as fast as I can. Do you hear me? Tom, do you hear me?
He hung the receiver up and dressed. In angry weariness, he opened the wall cabinet and collected scalpels and clamps, sponges and tubes of sutures to put in his bag. He shook his gasoline pressure lantern to make sure it was full and arranged ether can and mask beside it on his bureau. His wife in boudoir cap and nightgown looked in. Dr. Tilson said,
I'm walking over to the garage. Call Will Hamilton.
Tell him I want him to drive me to his father's place. If he argues, tell him his sister is dying.
Tom came riding back to the ranch a week after Dessie's funeral, riding high and prim, his shoulders straight and chin in, like a guardsman on parade. Tom had done everything slowly, perfectly. His horse was curried and brushed, and his Stetson hat was square on his head. Not even Samuel could have held himself in more dignity than Tom as he rode back to the old house. A hawk driving down on a chicken with doubled fists didn't make him turn his head. At the barn, he dismounted, watered his horse, held him a moment at the door, halted him, and put rolled barley in the box beside the manger. He took off the saddle and turned the blanket inside out to dry. Then the barley was finished, and he led the bay horse out and turned him free to graze on every unfenced inch of the world. In the house, the furniture, chairs, and stove seemed to shrink back and away from him in distaste. A stool avoided him as he went to the living room. His matches were soft and damp, and with a feeling of apology, he went to the kitchen for more. The lamp in the living room was fair and lonely. Tom's first match flame ran quickly around the Rochester wick and then stood up a full inch of yellow flame. Tom sat down in the evening and looked around. His eyes avoided the horsehair sofa. A slight noise of mice in the kitchen made him turn, and he saw his shadow on the wall, and his hat was on. He removed it and laid it on the table beside him. He thought dawdling, protective thoughts, sitting under the lamp, but he knew that pretty soon his name would be called, and he would have to go up before the bench with himself as judge and his own crimes as juror. And his name was called, shrilly in his ears. His mind walked in to face the accusers. Vanity, which charged him with being ill-dressed and dirty and vulgar. And lust, slipping him the money for his whoring. Dishonesty, to make him pretend to talent and thought he did not have. Laziness and gluttony, arm in arm. Tom felt comforted by these because they screened the great gray one in the back seat, waiting, the gray and dreadful crime. He dredged up lesser things, used small sins almost like virtues to save himself. There were covetousness of Will's money, treason toward his mother's God, theft of time and hope, sick rejection of love. Samuel spoke softly, but his voice filled the room. Be good, be pure, be great, be Tom Hamilton. Tom ignored his father. He said, I'm busy greeting my friends. And he nodded to discourtesy and ugliness and unfilial conduct and unkempt fingernails. Then he started with vanity again. The gray one shouldered up in front. It was too late to stall with baby sins. This gray one was murder. Tom's hand felt the chill of the glass and saw the pearly liquid with the dissolving crystals still turning over and lucent bubbles rising, and he repeated aloud in the empty, empty room, This'll do the job. Just wait till morning. You'll feel fine then. That's how it had sounded, exactly how. And the walls and chairs and the lamp had all heard it, and they could prove it. There was no place in the whole world for Tom Hamilton to live. But it wasn't for lack of trying. He shuffled possibilities like cards. London? No. Egypt? Pyramids in Egypt and the Sphinx? No. Paris? No. Now wait. They do all your sins a lot better there. No. We'll stand aside and maybe we'll come back to you. Bethlehem? Dear God, no. It would be lonely there for a stranger. And here, interpolated, it's so hard to remember how you die or when. An eyebrow raised, or a whisper. They may be it. Or a night mottled with splashed light, until powder-driven lead finds your secret and lets out the fluid in you. Now, this is true. Tom Hamilton was dead, and he had only to do a few decent things to make it final. The sofa creaked in criticism, and Tom looked at it and at the smoking lamp to which the sofa referred. Thank you, Tom said to the sofa. I hadn't noticed it. And he turned down the wick until the smoking stopped. His mind dozed. Murder slapped him aware again. Now Red Tom, Gum Tom, was too tired to kill himself. That takes some doing, with maybe pain and maybe hell. He remembered that his mother had a strong distaste for suicide, feeling that it combined three things of which he strongly disapproved: bad manners, cowardice, and sin. It was almost as bad as adultery or stealing, maybe just as bad. There must be a way to avoid Liza's disapproval. She could make one suffer if she disapproved. Samuel wouldn't make it hard, but on the other hand, you couldn't avoid Samuel because he was in the air every place. Tom had to tell Samuel. He said, My father, I'm sorry, I can't help it. You overestimated me. You were wrong. I wish I could justify the love and pride you squandered on me. Maybe you could figure a way out, but I can't. I cannot live. I've killed Desi, and I want to sleep. And his mind spoke for his father absent, saying, Why, I can understand how that would be. There are so many patterns to choose from in the arc from birth back to birth again. But let's think how we can make it all right with Mother. Why are you so impatient, dear? I can't wait, that's why, Tom said. I can't wait any more. Why, sure you can, my son, my darling. You're grown great, as I knew you would. Open the table drawer and then make use of that turnip you call your head. Tom opened the drawer and saw a tablet of Crane's linen lawn and a package of envelopes to match and two gnawed and crippled pencils and in the dust corner at the back a few stamps. He laid out the tablet and sharpened the pencils with his pocket knife. He wrote, "Dear Mother, I hope you keep yourself well. I'm going to plan to spend more time with you. Olive asked me for Thanksgiving, and you know I'll be there. Our little Olive can cook a turkey nearly to match yours, but I know you will never believe that. I've had a stroke of good luck. Bought a horse for $15, a gelding, and he looks like a blood horse to me. I got him cheap because he's taken a dislike to mankind. His former owner spent more time on his own back than on the geldings. I must say he's a pretty cute article. He's thrown me twice, but I'll get him yet. And if I can break him, I'll have one of the best horses in the whole county. And you can be sure I'll break him if it takes all winter. I don't know why I go on about him, only the man I bought him from said a funny thing. He said, that horse is so mean, he'd eat a man right off his back. Well, remember what Father used to say when we went rabbit hunting? Come back with your shield or on it. I'll see you Thanksgiving. Your son, Tom." He wondered whether it was good enough, but he was too tired to do it again. He added, "P.S. I noticed that Polly hasn't reformed one bit. That parrot makes me blush." On another sheet he wrote, "Dear Will, no matter what you yourself may think, please help me now. For Mother's sake, please. I was killed by a horse, thrown and kicked in the head. Please. Your brother Tom." He stamped the letters and put them in his pocket, and he asked Samuel, "Is that all right?" In his bedroom, he broke open a new box of shells and put one of them in the cylinder of his well-oiled Smith & Wesson 38, and he set the loaded chamber one space to the left of the firing pin. His horse, standing sleepily near the fence, came to his whistle and stood drowsing while he saddled up. It was 3 o'clock in the morning when he dropped the letters in the post office at King City and mounted and turned his horse south toward the unproductive hills of the old Hamilton place. He was a gallant gentleman.
This ends Disc 15. East of Eden, Disc 16.
Part 4. Chapter 34. A child may ask, "What is the world's story about?" And a grown man or woman may wonder, "What way will the world go? How does it end? And while we're at it, what's the story about?" I believe that there is one story in the world, and only one, that has frightened and inspired us, so that we live in a pearl-white serial of continuing thought and wonder. Humans are caught in their lives, in their thoughts, in their hungers and ambitions, in their avarice and cruelty, and in their kindness and generosity too, in a net of good and evil. I think this is the only story we have, and that it occurs on all levels of feeling and intelligence. Virtue and vice were warp and woof of our first consciousness, and they will be the fabric of our last, and this despite any changes we may impose on field and river and mountain, on economy and manners. There is no other story. A man, after he has brushed off the dust and chips of his life, will have left only the hard, clean questions. Was it good or was it evil? Have I done well or ill? Herodotus in the Persian War tells a story of how Croesus, the richest and most favored king of his time, asked Solon the Athenian a leading question. He wouldn't have asked if he hadn't been worried about the answer. "Who," he asked, "is the luckiest person in the world?" He must have been eaten with doubt and hungry for reassurance. Solon told him of 3 lucky people in old times. And Croesus more than likely didn't listen, so anxious was he about himself. And when Solon didn't mention him, Croesus was forced to say, "Don't you consider me lucky?" Solon didn't hesitate in his answer. "How can I tell?" he said. "You aren't dead yet." And this answer must have haunted Croesus dismally, as his luck disappeared and his wealth and his kingdom. And as he was being burned on a tall fire, he may have thought of it, and perhaps wished he hadn't asked, or had not been answered. And in our time, when a man dies, if he has had wealth and influence and power and all the vestments that arouse envy, and after the living take stock of the dead man's property and his eminence and works and monuments, the question is still there. Was his life good or was it evil? Which is another way of putting Croesus's question. Envies are gone, and the measuring stick is, was he loved or was he hated? Is his death felt as a loss, or does a kind of joy come of it? I remember clearly the deaths of three men. One was the richest man of the century, who, having clawed his way to wealth through the souls and bodies of men, spent many years trying to buy back the love he had forfeited, and by that process performed great service to the world, and perhaps had much more than balanced the evil of his rise. I was on a ship when he died. The news was posted on the bulletin board, and nearly everyone received the news with pleasure. Several said, "Thank God that son of a bitch is dead." Then there was a man, smart as Satan, who, lacking some perception of human dignity and knowing all too well every aspect of human weakness and wickedness, used his special knowledge to warp men, to buy men, to bribe and threaten and seduce until he found himself in a position of great power. He clothed his motives in the names of virtue, and I have wondered whether he ever knew that no gift will ever buy back a man's love when you have removed his self-love. A bribed man can only hate his briber. When this man died, the nation rang with praise and, just beneath, with gladness that he was dead. There was a third man, who perhaps made many errors in performance, but whose effective life was devoted to making men brave and dignified and good in a time when they were poor and frightened, and when ugly forces were loose in the world to utilize their fears. This man was hated by the few. When he died, the people burst into tears in the streets, and their minds wailed. What can we do now? How can we go on without him? In uncertainty, I am certain that underneath their topmost layers of frailty, men want to be good and want to be loved. Indeed, most of their vices are attempted shortcuts to love. When a man comes to die, no matter what his talents and influence and genius, if he dies unloved, his life must be a failure to him, and his dying a cold horror. It seems to me that if you or I must choose between two courses of thought or action, we should remember our dying and try so to live that our death brings no pleasure to the world. We have only one story. All novels, all poetry are built on the never-ending contest in ourselves of good and evil. And it occurs to me that evil must constantly respawn, while good, while virtue, is immortal. Vice always has a new, fresh, young face, while virtue is venerable as nothing else in the world is. Chapter 35. Lee helped Adam and the two boys move to Salinas, which is to say he did it all. Packed the things to be taken, saw them on the train, loaded the back seat of the Ford, and, arriving in Salinas, unpacked and saw the families settled in Desi's little house. When he had done everything he could think of to make them comfortable and a number of things unnecessary, and more things for the sake of delay, he waited on Adam formally one evening after the twins had gone to bed. Perhaps Adam caught his intention from Lee's coldness and formality. Adam said, "All right, I've been expecting it. Tell me." That broke up Lee's memorized speech, which he had intended to begin, "For a number of years I have served you to the best of my ability, and now I feel..." "I put it off as long as I could," said Lee. "I have a speech already. Do you want to hear it?"
Do you want to say it?
No, said Lee, I don't. And it's a pretty good speech, too.
When do you want to go? Adam asked.
As soon as possible. I'm afraid I might lose my intention if I don't go soon.
Do you want me to wait until you get someone else?
Better not, said Adam. You know how slow I am. It might be some time. I might never get around to it.
I'll go tomorrow, then.
It'll tear the boys to pieces, Adam said. I don't know what they'll do. Maybe you better sneak off and let me tell them afterward.
It's my observation that children always surprise us, said Lee.
And so it was. At breakfast the next morning, Adam said, Boys, Lee is going away.
Is he? Said Cal. There's a basketball game tonight. Costs 10 cents. Can we go?
Yes, but did you hear what I said?
Sure, said Aaron. You said Lee's going away.
But he's not coming back.
Cal asked, Where's he going?
To San Francisco to live.
Oh, said Aaron. There's a man on Main Street, right on the street, and he's got a little stove and he cooks sausages and puts them in buns. They cost a nickel, and you can take all the mustard you want.
Lee stood in the kitchen door, smiling at Adam. When the twins got their books together, Lee said, Goodbye, boys. And they shouted, Goodbye, and tumbled out of the house.
Adam stared into his coffee cup and said in apology, What little brutes! I guess that's your reward for over 10 years of service.
I like it better that way, Lee said. If they pretended sorrow, they'd be liars. It doesn't mean anything to them. Maybe they'll think of me sometimes, privately. I don't want them to be sad. I hope I'm not so small-souled as to take satisfaction in being missed.
He laid 50 cents on the table in front of Adam. When they start for the basketball game tonight, give them this from me and tell them to buy the sausage buns. My farewell gift may be ptomaine for all I know.
Adam looked at the telescope basket Lee brought into the dining room.
Is that all your stuff, Lee?
Everything but my books. They're in boxes in the cellar. If you don't mind, I'll send for them or come for them after I get settled.
Why, sure. I'm going to miss you, Lee, whether you want me to or not.
Are you really going to get your bookstore?
That is my intention.
You'll let us hear from you.
I don't know. I have to think about it. They say a clean cut heals soonest. There's nothing sadder to me than associations held together by nothing but the glue of postage stamps. If you can't see or hear or touch a man, it's best to let him go.
Adam stood up from the table. I'll walk to the depot with you.
No,
said Lee sharply.
No, I don't want that.
Goodbye, Mr. Trask.
Goodbye, Adam.
He went out of the house so fast that Adam's goodbye reached him at the bottom of the front steps, and Adam's don't forget to write sounded over the click of the front gate. That night after the basketball game, Cal and Aaron each had 5 sausages on buns, and it was just as well, for Adam had forgotten to provide any supper. Walking home, the twins discussed Lee for the first time.
I wonder why he went away, Cal asked. He's talked about going before. What do you suppose he'll do without us?
I don't know. I bet he comes back, Aaron said.
How do you mean? Father said he was going to start a bookstore.
That's funny, a Chinese bookstore.
He'll come back, said Aaron. He'll get lonesome for us, you'll see.
Bet you 10 cents he don't.
Before when?
Before forever.
That's a bet, said Aaron.
Aaron wasn't able to collect his winnings for nearly a month, but he won 6 days later. Lee came in on the 10:40 and let himself in with his own key. There was a light in the dining room, but Lee found Adam in the kitchen, scraping at a thick black crust in the frying pan with the point of a can opener. Lee put down his basket.
If you soak it overnight, it will come right out.
Will it? I've burned everything I've cooked. There's a saucepan of beets out in the yard. Smelled so bad I couldn't have them in the house. Burned beets are awful.
Lee! He cried.
And then, is anything the matter? Lee took the black iron pan from him and put it in the sink and ran water in it.
If we had a new gas stove, we could make a cup of coffee in a few minutes, he said. I might as well build up the fire.
Stove won't burn, said Adam.
Lee lifted the lid. Have you ever taken the ashes out?
Ashes?
Oh, go in the other room, said Lee. I'll make some coffee. Adam waited impatiently in the dining room, but he obeyed his orders. At last, Lee brought in two cups of coffee and set them on the table.
Made it in a skillet, he said. Much faster.
He leaned over his telescope basket and untied the rope that held it shut. He brought out the stone bottle.
Chinese absinthe, he said. In copy may last 10 more years. I forgot to ask whether you had replaced me.
You're beating around the bush, said Adam.
I know it. I also know the best way would be just to tell it and get it over with.
You lost your money in a fantan game.
No, I wish that was it. No, I have my money. This damn cork's broken. I'll have to shove it in the bottle.
He poured the black liquor into his coffee.
I never drank it this way, he said.
Say, it's good.
Tastes like rotten apples, said Adam.
Yes, but remember Sam Hamilton said like good rotten apples.
Adam said, when do you think you'll get around to telling me what happened to you?
Nothing happened to me, said Lee. I got lonesome. That's all. Isn't that enough?
How about your bookstore?
I don't want a bookstore. I think I knew it before I got on the train. But I took all this time to make sure.
Then there's your last dream gone.
Good riddance.
Lee seemed on the verge of hysteria.
Missy Trask, Chinese boys think gun get drunk.
Adam was alarmed.
What's the matter with you, anyway?
Lee lifted the bottle to his lips and took a deep, hot drink and panted the fumes out of his burning throat.
Adam, he said, I am incomparably, incredibly, overwhelmingly glad to be home. I've never been so goddamn lonesome in my life.
Chapter 36. Salinas had two grammar schools, big yellow structures with tall windows. And the windows were baleful, and the doors didn't smile. These schools were called the East End and the West End. Since the East End school was way to hell and gone across town, and the children who lived east of Main Street attended there, I won't bother with it. The West End, a huge building of two stories, fronted with gnarled poplars, divided the play yards called Girl Side and Boy Side. Behind the school, a high board fence separated Girl Side from Boy Side, and the back of the play yard was bounded by a slough of standing water, in which tall tules and even cattails grew. The West End had grades from 3rd to 8th. The 1st and 2nd graders went to baby school some distance away. In the West End, there was a room for each grade, 3rd, 4th, and 5th on the ground floor, 6th, 7th, and 8th on the second floor. Each room had the usual desks of battered oak, a platform and square teacher's desk, one Seth Thomas clock, and one picture. The pictures identified the rooms, and the Pre-Raphaelite influence was overwhelming. Galahad, standing in full armor, pointed the way for 3rd graders. Atalanta's race urged on the 4th. The pot of basil confused the 5th grade, and so on until the denunciation of Catiline sent the 8th graders on to high school with a sense of high civic virtue. Cal and Aaron were assigned to the 7th grade because of their age, and they learned every shadow of its picture. Laocoon, completely wrapped in snakes. The boys were stunned by the size and grandeur of the West End after their background in a one-room country school.
The opulence of having a teacher for each grade made a deep impression on them. It seemed wasteful. But as is true of all humans, they were stunned for one day, admiring on the second, and on the third day couldn't remember very clearly ever having gone to any other school. The teacher was dark and pretty, and by a judicious raising or withholding of hands, the twins had no worries. Cal worked it out quickly and explained it to Aaron.
"You take most kids," he said. "If they know the answer, why, they'll hold up their hands. And if they don't know, they'll just crawl under the desk. Know what we're going to do?"
"No, what?"
"Well, you notice the teacher don't always call on somebody with his hand up. She lets drive at the others, and sure enough, they don't know."
"That's right," said Aaron.
"Now, first week, we're going to work like bedamned, but we won't stick up our hands. So she'll call on us, and we'll know. That'll throw her. So the second week, we won't work, and we'll stick up our hands, and she won't call on us. Third week, we'll just sit quiet, and she won't ever know whether we got the answer or not. Pretty soon, she'll let us alone. She isn't going to waste her time calling on somebody that knows."
Cal's method worked. In a short time, the twins were not only let alone, but got themselves a certain reputation for smartness. As a matter of fact, Cal's method was a waste of time. Both boys learned easily enough. Cal was able to develop his marble game and set about gathering all the chalkies and emmys, glassies, and agates in the schoolyard. He traded them for tops just as marble season ended. At one time he had, and used as legal tender, at least 45 tops of various sizes and colors, from the thick, clumsy baby tops to the lean and dangerous splitters with their needle points. Everyone who saw the twins remarked on their difference one from the other, and seemed puzzled that this should be so. Cal was growing up dark-skinned, dark-haired. He was quick and sure and secret. Even though he may have tried, he couldn't conceal his cleverness. Adults were impressed with what seemed to them a precocious maturity, and they were a little frightened at it, too. No one liked Cal very much, yet everyone was touched with a fear of him, and through fear, with respect. Although he had no friends, he was welcomed by his obsequious classmates and took up a natural and cold position of leadership in the schoolyard. If he concealed his ingenuity, he concealed his hurts, too. He was regarded as thick-skinned and insensitive, even cruel. Aaron drew love from every side. He seemed shy and delicate. His pink and white skin, golden hair, and wide-set blue eyes caught attention. In the schoolyard, his very prettiness caused some difficulty, until it was discovered by his testers that Aaron was a dogged, steady, and completely fearless fighter, particularly when he was crying. Word got around, and the natural punishers of new boys learned to let him alone. Aaron didn't attempt to hide his disposition. It was concealed by being the opposite of his appearance. He was unchanging once a course was set. He had few facets and very little versatility. His body was as insensitive to pain as was his mind to subtleties. Cal knew his brother and could handle him by keeping him off balance, but this only worked up to a certain point. Cal had learned when to sidestep, when to run away. Change of direction confused Aaron, but that was the only thing that confused him. He set his path and followed it, and he didn't see, nor was he interested in, anything beside his path. His emotions were few and heavy. All of him was hidden by his angelic face, and for this he had no more concern or responsibility than has a fawn for the dappling spots on its young hide. On Aaron's first day in school, he waited eagerly for the recess. He went over to the girl's side to talk to Abra. A mob of squealing girls couldn't drive him out. It took a full-grown teacher to force him back to the boy's side. At noon, he missed her, for her father came by in his high-wheeled buggy and drove her home for lunch. He waited outside the schoolyard gate for her after school. She came out surrounded by girls. Her face was composed and gave no sign that she expected him. She was far the prettiest girl in the school, but it's doubtful whether Aaron had noticed that. The cloud of girls hung on and hung on, Aaron marched along 3 paces behind them, patient and unembarrassed, even when the girls tossed their squealing barbs of insult over their shoulders at him. Gradually, some drifted away to their own homes, and only 3 girls were with Abra when she came to the white gate of her yard and turned in. Her friends stared at him a moment, giggled, and went on their way. Aaron sat down on the edge of the sidewalk. After a moment, the latch lifted, the white gate opened, and Abra emerged. She walked across the walk and stood over him.
"What do you want?"
Aaron's wide eyes looked up at her.
"You aren't engaged to anybody?"
"Silly," she said. He struggled up to his feet.
"I guess it'll be a long time before we can get married," he said.
"Who wants to get married?" Aaron didn't answer. Perhaps he didn't hear. He walked along beside her. Abra moved with firm and deliberate steps, and she faced straight ahead. There was wisdom and sweetness in her expression. She seemed deep in thought, and Aaron, walking beside her, never took his eyes from her face. His attention seemed tied to her face by a taut string. They walked silently past the baby school, and there the pavement ended. Abra turned right and led the way through the stubble of the summer's hayfield. The black dobe clods crushed under their feet. On the edge of the field stood a little pump house, and a willow tree flourished beside it, fed by the overspill of water. The long skirts of the willow hung down nearly to the ground. Abra parted the switches like a curtain and went into the house of leaves made against the willow trunk by the sweeping branches. You could see out through the leaves, but inside it was sweetly protected and warm and safe. The afternoon sunlight came yellow through the aging leaves. Abra sat down on the ground, or rather she seemed to drift down, and her full skirts settled in a billow around her. She folded her hands in her lap, almost as though she were praying. Aaron sat down beside her.
"I guess it'll be a long time before we can get married," he said again.
"Not so long," Abra said.
"I wish it was now."
"It won't be so long," said Abra. Aaron asked,
"Do you think your father will let you?"
It was a new thought to her, and she turned and looked at him.
"Maybe I won't ask him."
"But your mother?"
"Let's not disturb them," she said. "They think it was funny or bad."
"Can't you keep a secret?"
"Oh, yes, I can keep secrets better than anybody. And I've got some, too,"
Abra said. "Well, you just put this one with the others." Aaron picked up a twig and drew a line on the black earth.
"Abra, do you know how you get babies?"
"Yes," she said.
"Who told you?"
"Lee told me. He explained the whole thing. I guess we can't have any babies for a long time." Abra's mouth turned up at the corners with a condescending wisdom.
"Not so long," she said. "We'll have a house together sometime," Aaron said, bemused. "We'll go in and close the door, and it'll be nice. But that'll be a long time."
Abra put out her hand and touched him on the arm.
"Don't you worry about long times," she said. "This is a kind of a house. We can play like we live here while we're waiting. And you will be my husband, and you can call me wife."
He tried it over under his breath and then aloud.
"Wife," he said. "It'll be like practicing," said Abra.
Aaron's arm shook under her hand, and she put it, palm up, in her lap. Aaron said suddenly,
"While we're practicing, maybe we could do something else."
"What?"
"Maybe you wouldn't like it."
"What is it?"
"Maybe we could pretend like you're my mother."
"That's easy," she said.
"Would you mind?"
"No, I'd like it."
"Do you want to start now?"
"Sure," Aaron said.
"How do you want to go about it?"
"Oh, I can tell you that," said Abra. She put a cooing tone in her voice and said,
"Come, my baby. Put your head in Mother's lap. Come, my little son. Mother will hold you."
She drew his head down, and without warning, Aaron began to cry and couldn't stop. He wept quietly, and Abra stroked his cheek and wiped the flowing tears away with the edge of her skirt. The sun crept down toward its setting place behind the Salinas River, and a bird began to sing wonderfully from the golden stubble of the field. It was as beautiful under the branches of the willow tree as anything in the world can be. Very slowly, Aaron's weeping stopped,